This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
This is another podcast of Worldwide Wave, the international LGBT news and current affairs show. Every week on Australia's first LGBT radio station, Joy 94.9.
Surfing the globe, bringing you news, views, and current affairs for the LGBT community, this is the Worldwide Wave.
Welcome, folks. This is Worldwide Wave, Joy's international news and current affairs show. We like to take you around the globe, one country at a time. Tonight in the studio, hello, Dean.
Hi, Matt.
Damien's here too.
Hello.
And I am Matt. The arrival of Western forces in Iraq was portrayed in our media and by our politicians as saving their country from tyranny. But what about the gays and lesbians in Iraq or war-torn Syria?
Is their life now better or worse than under the former regime?
With the mass exodus of refugees from Syria and Iraq, what is life like for LGBT refugees escaping persecution?
And how can you portray the trials of these people to a Western audience like Australia? For a look at the journey of LGBTI Syrian and Iranian refugees, joining us in the studio are Lyle Brooks and Nick Simpson-Deeks of the midsummer premiere event Elegy. It opens next week at Gaswork Arts Park.
Plus, we hear from a new program for friends and family of LGBT Iranians from Jessica Stern, the Executive Director of Outright Action International. Here's a taste of what you've got coming tonight.
We've had an amazing, amazing response from the Iranian community. It's actually gone viral in Farsi, which is, of course, our primary audience. So it just goes to show that things are changing in Iran. There's more and more acceptance of LGBTI people, and we hope everyone's going to take a look at Yusuf and Farhad.
Worldwide Wrap, LGBT news from around the world, scanning the globe for stories for the diverse gay and lesbian communities from Australia's Joy 94.9. This is the Worldwide Wrap.
Starting off in the Pacific with Fiji, where Fijian Prime Minister Frank Bainimarama has said that LGBT people in the Pacific Island nation should go to Iceland and stay there.
I've always wanted to go to Iceland. It's on my bucket list.
I did actually see somebody comment on our post saying, well, if he pays, I'll go.
Yeah, it's really expensive. Like a Big Mac is like $9 there.
Oh, well.
Yeah, it's like one of the most expensive countries in the world.
Another reason not to eat Big Macs.
Thanks, Frank. If you want to open your wallet there, we'd be happy to go.
I don't think that's in his plans. He was responding to a comment from the coordinator of the Fijian Women's Crisis Centre, who was actually calling on the government to legalise gay marriage. And pretty much he said, there will be no same-sex marriage in Fiji, not in her lifetime, not in ours. You know, I bet there's a lot of people who would have said that from Ireland and USA going a few years back as well. But look what happened there.
Well, Frank was saying that if two women want to marry, they should go and have it done in Iceland and stay and live there. Fiji does not need that rubbish. Now, probably he knows a bit of political history because the first openly gay leader of any country was Iceland's lesbian prime minister.
Yeah.
So there you go.
And probably more people going to Iceland than Fiji at the moment. Now, one of the people involved there has called him out on this, saying that his statements are not in keeping with what the government has been saying about human rights, about violence against women, and their own aspirations to be on the UN Human Rights Council.
Oh, yeah, it's a load of rubbish. So, yeah, and everyone around the world's laughing at him. Moving on to China, where there's some interesting news. There's been the first ever lawsuit challenging Chinese same-sex marriage ban lodged at court, and the court has accepted the application.
Woohoo!
Which is a bit unusual because they don't usually accept political-style disputes.
The government normally shuts them down before it even gets to court.
Well, the courts know what to do. I mean, you know, they don't have the separation of powers that we have. So in China, courts often reject politically sensitive cases. So the fact that the lawsuit's rights even been accepted signals some official willingness to address discrimination against LGBT people. Basically, a gay man in Changsha, which is one of the... it's in the Hunan province, that's it, has complained that they refused to receive his marriage registration application. And he applied for a marriage license last year. They said, no, thank you. And he and his partner have been together for 1 year. And he says that the officials of the Bureau stated that only one man and one woman can register to marry.
Hang on. Is John Howard working as an official in China?
Well, he's got a lot on, Actually, no, he wouldn't have much on, so...
That's right. It is interesting. So homosexuality is not actually illegal in China, and some of the larger cities actually have thriving gay communities.
Yes, but it's kind of that underground thing, like Singapore, where it's, Singapore, it is illegal, but again,
it's tolerated, it's known, so long as it doesn't become too visible, then, we'll just let it go.
Pretty much. So the Chinese couple have celebrated their love in front of each other by having a ceremony, but they want to, take it a bit further.
And look, it is the start of change, and we're sort of seeing these things because it was only 2001 that China delisted homosexuality as a mental disorder. So that's pretty rapid change. And for us, it was about 1970-odd, and, we're still not at this place now with same-sex marriage.
And certainly on World Wide Wave, we're talking about China more and more often. So there's more and more news coming out of China, which is a good thing.
Across to Tunisia, where an appeals court last week ordered the release of a group of students who had been sentenced to 3 years in prison for sodomy. And the Tunisian advocacy group there has appealed a 30-day suspension by the government.
Oh, plus an extra 6 months for one of the students because they found pornographic videos on his computer.
If they put every student who had porn on their computer in jail, their jails will be full. The appeals court has scheduled to hear the case again in February, so it's not yet over, but it is a good sign that they have at least let them free. Tunisia is among many countries in that region where consensual same-sex sexual activity is still criminalised.
And the student's release comes 3 days after the government suspended SHAMS, which I think is Arabic for sun, an organisation that seeks to repeal Tunisia's anti-sodomy law, and they've suspended them for 30 days because of non-compliance with the rule of law.
So they've got a gay group who they're saying didn't comply with law because they're talking about gay things. Isn't that what they're meant to be doing?
Well, yeah.
Am I applying logic to this?
Talking about gay things, but not too loudly, I think, is the case.
Across to India now. India's first transgender band has released its debut single, Hum Hain Happy. It's a Bollywood cover of Pharrell Williams' song, Happy, and we are happy to play it here tonight. Now, India is a country that has recently recriminalized homosexuality.
Bow-bow.
And but on the other hand, they have acknowledged the third gender. So Hijras, they don't have a great life in India. They are quite often discriminated against. They're given very low-paid jobs.
But they do make damn good music.
They do. And we are going to post the video of this on our Facebook page, which is W3Joy.
Hi, my name is Robbie Watt. I'm from Kootjuk, northern Quebec in Canada, and you're listening to the World Wide Wave.
Speaking of messengers, we've actually got some here on World Wide Wave. Let's see. In lieu of David Bowie's death, it's interesting to note he married the daughter of a Sudanese refugee. That's Iman, the internationally renowned supermodel for the rest of you. He was a strong champion of human rights in art as a result, and rest in peace for an icon that also had a strong social conscience.
And we've got a little tribute to him later in the show as well, and a message in too on Facebook from Pete. Thanks, Pete. Great to get back to... This is relating to our show for tonight, actually, saying great to get back to what equality is all about. Indeed it is. We've got in the studio with us Lyle Brooks and Nick Simpson-Deeks. They are from the midsummer premiere event Elegy. Welcome, guys.
Hi. Well, thank you. Thanks for having us.
Start by giving us a bit of an overview of the story of Elegy. What will people who attend this performance experience?
We could do this word at a time, couldn't
sure
we?
Sure, we could. Do you want to field this one?
Like a bad theatre sports show.
Sure, off you go.
Okay, so Elegy is it's a one-man piece or a one-actor piece that essentially tells the story, ostensibly tells the story of one gay Iraqi refugee's journey, a flight from persecution across Europe to the UK. I say ostensibly because it is actually based on a whole bunch of real-life interviews with gay refugees in Europe and abroad. So it's kind of, it's a true story.
Yeah, well, many true stories.
It's many true stories filtered into one
narrative.
Yeah.
It's, and at its heart, it's actually a love story.
Yes.
Yes. It wouldn't be a story if it didn't have the love story element to it, I guess. It's a bit, I mean, people come along knowing that it's a tragic love story.
Okay.
Bring in the punters.
And if
bring
they don't,
the punters,
they didn't, they do
it.
Now.
That's right.
Is it difficult to balance that, you know, the emotions of love with some, I would imagine, some fairly harrowing experiences?
Mm, I feel like those two things, I mean, in my personal life, they seem to be pretty closely interlocked. And I think Shakespeare felt the same thing probably too. I mean, I don't think that it's difficult to balance it. I think the love story is really important for us to cling on to in sort of realizing the piece, because otherwise it has, I think, less value to an audience. You know, love is something that we're trying to... I mean, the power of the piece is, I think, it is universality, in a sense, that we're looking at themes that are common to everybody. So, yes, it is the plight of a gay refugee or the stories of many gay refugees fleeing persecution specifically, but what makes it so relatable, I think, and what's so potentially powerful about it is that everybody understands love, everybody understands loss, personal loss. So I think it's intrinsic. If you don't have the love, you can't have the tragedy. You know what I mean?
And this is a very visual experience too, because it's actually you're using some of the photography from a photographer.
No, we're not using any photography in the show itself. The show is, for those who don't know, is based on or was influenced by, inspired by the work of a photojournalist called Bradley Secker, who does a lot of work in the Middle East. He's based in Turkey. He did a couple of series, actually, based on a lot of gay refugees who were caught in limbo at the time, in 2010, in Damascus, in Syria. Of course, the whole story is quite different now. They've all moved on from there. So we're pairing the show with a gallery exhibition at Gasworks,
right,
because they have some beautiful gallery spaces there. So you can actually see a lot of these people, a lot of these subjects that the show was kind of based on and experience the show, but just not at the same time.
He was trying to get across a message that life is not necessarily all rosy now that the Western cavalry has come into Iraq.
No,
is that something that you've
Yeah, it's interesting, and we talk a lot about this, and it's still a big question for us, I think, you know, knowing what we do about it. It's very different to being on the ground there and understanding the nuances of what happens after. What's the word we use in the script? After liberation. Yeah, you know,
Operation Freedom, was it?
There are a lot of that's right. Operation Freedom.
Freedom Storm.
Yes. Installing. Yeah. You know, and the thing that the Western powers are prone to doing, like installing, you know, dictators and forcing these democracies into well, that's very complex. I mean, anyone trying to understand what's happening in Syria, for example, right now, it's kind of just pulling their hair out because it seems like really no one knows what's going on. You have these power vacuums created. You have all these different sort of threads of fighting, and there are references in the show about, that speak to how more difficult life became for LGBTI people after the war, which is interesting. And we don't, but that's all we get, really. We have to kind of nut through the text and figure out, well, why is that and why would that be exactly? And how do the difficulties change?
I mean, Baghdad itself had quite, I don't want to say thriving, but had quite a liberated gay scene back in the 60s and 70s, would you believe? And I guess no one in Australia is under any illusions anymore that the invasion of Iraq was a good thing, that the things that are happening now in the Middle East aren't sort of directly related to what happened. There's a consequence of what happened then. And we weren't so naive to believe that it was all about freedom and liberation at the time. But I guess we are still quite naive that we thought maybe we are doing good in some way, but the opposite has happened. They're not liberated. You know, the opposite has come in. They created this vacuum where a lot of militia have stepped in.
That's right.
Militia who used to be hired for security, kind of security a lot of the times, and when the new powers that be were in power, they kind of had nothing to do.
Yeah.
I don't want to say, you know, they're idle. It makes it sound so trivial, but a lot of these militia who sort of trained and their whole purpose was security turned to kind of very strong conservative moral policing.
Yeah, the moral policing came off the back of them having less power in a military sense. You know, once you have the US or you have Western powers in there, and these other smaller groups feel powerless in that sense, so they turn to sort of ethical,
they use morality.
Yeah, they use morality, and so they have to direct that power somewhere. Yeah. The unfortunate thing about minorities, especially gay men, for example, in Iraq or Syria, or gay women, queer people, it's very difficult because there's no support base there. And I've been reading a bit about this in The Guardian lately, mm-hmm. that there are no votes in protecting homosexual people in Syria, or there's no base, there's no support.
There's not even a word for homosexual in Arabic.
We just found this out recently, and so it's a very easy target then to use the execution of gay men for publicity, which is what ISIS is doing now, to use that as an example of their power and to show the world what the sort of brutality they're capable of, because they're not going to, there's almost no repercussion.
They're not getting anyone offside apart from the homosexuals.
There's no political repercussion. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So the things that are happening with ISIS, and they're throwing suspected gay people off buildings. And just last week, there was reports of a 15-year-old who that happened to. As you say, one of the things they're after here is publicity. They know that when they do this, it's going to get attention around the world. Is it a good thing for us to be giving air to that and saying how bad it is, or is it something that, by giving it that air, we're actually self-serving them? What do you think?
It's a really good question.
It's a fine line, isn't it?
It is. And I honestly feel like a performance at Gasworks probably isn't going to, give them a huge amount of publicity. So there's that. But, it's a really good question, and I'm not sure what the answer to that is.
Specifically in this case, we're not talking about artists. This was only written 4 years ago, but so much has changed since then. Yeah, you're right. It is a tricky line to traverse, isn't it, when you want to make people aware, awareness versus the publicity that they're obviously after.
You're on World Wide Wave.
Hi, I'm Bisi Alimi, and I'm fighting for LGBT rights of people in Nigeria. It's great to know we have friends and supporters like you at Joy 94.9.
Tonight we are looking at refugees from Iraq and Syria with our guests Lyle and Nick from the show Elegy. Message coming in there?
Yes, from 317, our old friend. Good on you. Janet Holmes of Court said today on radio that she was in a taxi in New York, and the taxi driver said that our country is known for how harsh we are to asylum seekers. Our reputation has been tarnished as well. Great to see the community recognising a minority group through art. Great stuff.
Mm. That's an interesting aspect to this. So it is a story about Middle Eastern refugees going to Europe, but does it reflect on Australia, and does it reflect on Australia's refugee policy?
Of course it does. It has to. Yeah, of course it does. We have a government and apparently an opposition now as well who seem determined to diminish the sort of values of, I think, empathy and even the total lack of humanitarianism that we're sort of seeing in this government makes me so mad, because I think, I personally, and I don't know how everyone in the room here feels, but I personally have felt for a long time that I'm being represented by a government who represents me in no way at all. I feel very strongly about empathy, about social responsibility, about our responsibility to other people, and this kind of fear-mongering that we seem to have learned from, I don't know, we've learned from the US, or we've learned from media, Western media in general, that we seem to be, utilizing now in order to, I assume to score more votes with the middle ground of Australia. Whatever the motivation, I think it's reprehensible. I think Australia has really shirked responsibility.
So we do see this politicisation, not just here though, in Germany with those New Year's Eve attacks that were blamed on refugees, the Paris bombings. There was lots of talk about being refugees.
Yeah.
Can something like this play help to dispel that?
In a small way, I hope so. One of the reasons we chose this play, we chose to pursue getting the rights to this play and to put it on, was because there's a deliberate choice in the play to cast the lead role of this guy, who turns out to be, an Iraqi refugee, as a Caucasian, as a white guy. And I think The point of it is that you listen to this story, you listen to a love story about someone's displacement. There's no really specific things in the play that say it is Baghdad or this is Syria or now we're in whatever this place is. Mm. The point is you feel like you might be watching the guy next door. and you, as shallow as that is, we as an audience do connect with
what's familiar to us, and
we're playing to a white middle class audience in Australia. We always are in theatre, so I think that's why we chose the piece. It also, on the flip side, is one of the biggest misgivings we had about this piece is what right do we have to make this incredibly personal Middle Eastern story as a bunch of
fairly privileged,
white guys, basically,
living a long way away and not really.
Yeah, I didn't want to become disconnected. Sure. I didn't want it to be misery porn. God,
it's difficult to. It's harrowing subject matter, and just to go on from what you were saying, I think part of the power of. And we hope that theatre in some way can help to change people's minds or have some people, have some people look at an issue slightly differently. Otherwise, what are we doing it for? It's certainly not for the paycheck. I think that part of the power of the elegy is in that choice, is in the scale. And it is a story that, despite it being deliberately generic about, I think, time and place, it focuses in on one person, on those nuances, on those quirks that we all have, and by placing a white Australian narrator in the centre of it, you're looking at someone who is familiar to you, and it's sort of relatable in a way that gets past all of the overwhelmingness of looking at this stuff on the news, looking at thousands of people, looking at thousands of faces, looking at these enormous kind of expanding camps, and that those huge pictures that we see that just make us, I think, go, well, it's too big. There's nothing we can do. And we're dehumanized. The issue is kind of we become desensitized to it because there's nothing human there really to cling on to.
Part of that Western narrative is, by getting out and we're taking you in, we're saving you. Being a refugee is such a long, hard journey because even if you get to a country that accepts you,
it's usually temporarily.
That's right, yeah, and there's whole lots of other issues there. Are you able to get into that sort of thing within Elegy?
No. Like Nick said, it's this massive topic. How much can you cover?
We do get into the process of how difficult it is once you arrive in after this journey fraught with all sorts of difficulty and danger. How difficult it is then to the process of being in a country where suddenly you're being interviewed, you don't speak the language, and we get into that. That's as far as the story of Elegy takes us.
Which is how far the story gets for most refugees, like you were saying. A lot of them will stay in limbo for years and years and years, and that's kind of how the play goes too.
Yeah.
What about discrimination or even attacks by refugees of LGBTI refugees? So
yes,
there's lots of stories there whereby, it's, I guess, is it a mix of survival of the fittest or is it just what they have been brought up with in terms of religion or culture?
It's funny, that's one of the things in the play it touches on. That's one of the few things that I hadn't kind of connected with or found examples of until very recently. Just a few days ago, I found an article and it covered the story of this man who fled Baghdad to Syria, very similar to this other guy that we're talking about in the play, and then he's kind of just city-hopped around the Middle East into Europe for the past 5-6 years. Like, that's been his transit because he'll get to a city, stay there for put down whatever route you can for a year, and he'll start to recognise people from the militias that he knew from back in Baghdad, even kids that he grew up with who
or
joined
family.
The militias.
In one example, there was a guy talking about his family who had pursued him across borders into other countries to kill him. I mean, it's incredible. So what it does, it kind of puts you in this world where you can't trust anybody. You can't trust anybody. You don't know which authorities have been infiltrated by militia in whatever country you might be in. You don't know if the UN has been infiltrated. You don't know whether your family will turn you in. You know, it's you can't.
And as a consequence of that too, because you can't trust anyone, and you have a very good reason not to. Often, when these refugees get to, for example, they get to Australia or the UK, their stories may sound to the interviewers as lies or very flimsy because they're used to covering the truth or they're used to creating a story to get them by. And after 5-6 years or more in transit,
blurry. I mean,
they don't know what the truth is anymore.
Yeah, and that's a huge part of this story is trying to put.
So survival is lying, effectively.
Effectively, yeah. And so, and of course, you also, I think, doing a play that takes, 55, 60 minutes in a tiny little space, you forget that this is years and years and years and years of a journey, maybe staying in one city for a year or so, moving on when you have to. It's, I mean, we sort of mapped this out one day, and it was incredibly surprising to me that we start this journey with this guy when he's probably just in, you know, making it into his early 20s, and we're I mean, realistically, we're probably 30 or so by the time he gets to the UK in this story. So it's it must be very confusing. And I keep thinking about that line from Serial, from the podcast, where at the beginning of season one, where, you know, where she sort of asks you to think about what you're doing last Thursday or two Thursday or whatever it is, and it's between, and then, you know, imagine trying to go back and recount every part of this journey, every moment you were traveling, or how did you get from this point to this point. It makes perfect sense that either you can't remember, or you've been so conditioned not to tell that particular part of it because it's going to give you away, that you just would. I mean, how do you retain a story?
Yeah. Nick, for you as an actor, how do you get into the mindset of being a refugee?
I mean, it's all, look, everything is there in the text. And what is interesting about the show is that it's not a matter of me necessarily getting into the mindset of a refugee. I think you come back to those things that are sort of universally common and human. So you come back to love, you come back to loss, you come back to betrayal, you come back to confusion and all of those things. And if, you know, as much as the personalization of an actor goes, that's plenty to draw on. I think we're also deliberately ambiguous in the piece, and then the writing is sort of ambiguous in a way in terms of who is actually telling the story. A lot of it's told in third person without wanting to give too much of the show away, but there's this kind of separation of character that happens in the show where we're watching someone tell a story about someone who may be separate to himself as a protective sort of mechanism, perhaps, who eventually, you know, or at some point during the play, bleeds into that character, owns that character, and we have a sense the whole time that he is telling his story. But there's this separation that happens. It's one-man shows are, I think, very challenging for actors in a lot of ways, and this one in particular, because it's non-linear in the narrative. There are interweaving sort of strands of story, and it's a matter of detailing what is spoken to the audience, what is lived in you know, inside the space, and we're still, I think, kind of discovering how that works. And it's been, I mean, John's been great, and it's been, you know, a real challenge, and we'll.
You've only got a few more days to discover.
Yeah,
well,
you know, it's all
stop
part
exploring,
of
it's all, Nick. It's on.
It's all part of the process, but so it's not a matter of stepping into that mindset. I think the power of it is saying to an audience, you know how this works. You know how this is.
So opening is next week.
Yes, Tuesday, Wednesday previews, cheaper tickets come, opening on Thursday night for 3 weeks of the festival.
And it's Gasworks Arts Park, which is a great venue, great Midsummer supporter. Lyle Brooks and Nick Simpson-Deeks from Elegy, Midsummer Premier Event. Thanks for joining us here
tonight.
Thanks
so much for having us.
Thanks, guys.
Want to hear more? Find out about LGBT life in over 100 countries. Download free podcasts of this show. Subscribe to iTunes or follow us on Twitter. Visit joy.org.au/worldwidewave.
This is Scott from the Equality Network Scotland on the World Wide Wave.
Messages, small messages coming in, which is great.
Yes, art can change the world. Look at David Bowie.
True.
We love our gratuitous David Bowie references.
And we've got a Bowie song coming up too.
We do actually. And we also have some other messages on Facebook because we love our Facebook followers.
So we posted a story, a Toronto-based photographer who's put out some images of LGBT Muslims called Just Me and Allah, a queer Muslim photo project. Got lots and lots of likes, and Pete says, absolutely fantastic. Really worth a look. W3Joy on Facebook.
We also had a much less happy story from Pakistan about a trans woman who was shot in a drive-by shooting, and the hospital refused to help for 3 hours, instead made fun of the poor woman, and Greg said, angry face.
Now, in addition, tonight, or a few weeks back, we spoke with Jessica Stern, the Executive Director of Outright Action International in New York, about their Out Summit for LGBT activists. And at the time, we also learnt about an innovative program they've got to support LGBTI Iranians. Tell us about the project, Yusuf and Farid, and why it came about in a storytelling way.
Outright tends to publish a lot of
human rights reports and legal analysis, and that's obviously incredibly important for reaching governments and for trying to persuade institutions like the police to actually pay attention to us. But there was another audience that we were missing, and that is actually the families and friends of LGBTI Iranians. And so we wanted to actually publish something with a different kind of voice, something that was going to be a little bit more accessible, a little bit more fun to read, a little bit more relatable than something with 2,000 footnotes. And so we got this idea to actually do a graphic novel, and I love it. I think it's so beautiful and so important. It's called Yusuf and Farhad, and it follows the story of a gay couple in Iran and their struggle for family acceptance. And it's nuanced, and it's complicated, and it's funny, and it's sweet and romantic, and it just goes to show an old dog can learn new tricks. So if a human rights organization can learn to write something that's actually fun to read and not overly legalistic, well, then we hope even the most homophobic and transphobic parents can start to see something relatable so they can actually be there for their LGBTI children. And we know we've had an amazing, amazing response from the Iranian community. And it's actually gone viral in Farsi, which is, of course, our primary audience. So it just goes to show that things are changing in Iran. There's more and more acceptance of LGBTI people, and we hope everyone's going to take a look at Yusuf and Farhad, which is actually available in both English and Farsi, and check it out for themselves.
And you said it's a graphic novel, which is sort of cartoon style. I would imagine using the visuals allows it to get to a very wide audience. It's very accessible. That would knock down any literacy barriers as well.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And the language isn't fancy. You know, if you've reached a sort of the reading level of your average 10-year-old, you can love this story. So it's very accessible. The drawings are really fun. And when I say graphic novel, I guess that's the kind of term du jour, but someone else would just call it by its old-fashioned name. It's a comic book.
Receive LGBT news from around the world throughout the week. Like World Wide Wave on Facebook now.
This is Douglas.
And this is Paula.
From Kaleidoscope Australia Human Rights Foundation, keeping a watchful eye on LGBTI rights across Asia and the Pacific.
On the World Wide Wave.
Oh, and don't we love them?
We do. In fact, Paula's coming back to speak to us in a couple of weeks' time. A big thank you tonight to Lyle and Nick from the stage play Elegy. It's a midsummer premiere event on at Gasworks Arts Park from the 19th of Jan to the 6th of Feb. Tickets at midsummer.org.au.
Also, Jessica Stern, the Executive Director of Outright Action International, talking about the graphic novel.
Heaps and heaps of messages on Facebook this week. Gyro, Scott, Vinny, Christine, David, Marion, and a heap more. So join our community there, W3Joy, and receive international LGBT news throughout the week. Now, as promised, we would be remiss if we did not make mention of David Bowie and his queerness and his impact on the queer community. So we've got a little David Bowie song to take us out.
Boys Keep Swinging from Lodger, which features him in drag in the video.
Love it.
We loved you, David, and we still do.
We do. We'll catch you next week on World Wide Wave.
Thanks for listening to another podcast of World Wide Wave, a show that takes you around the globe one country at a time. World Wide Wave is the international news and current affairs show on Australia's LGBT radio station, Joy 94.9. You can listen live every Tuesday night from 7 p.m. Eastern Australian Time on 94.9 FM in Melbourne or online at joy.org.au. You'll find all of our podcasts at joy.org.au/worldwidewave. Or follow us on Facebook for the latest international LGBT news. Search W3Joy on Facebook now.
Great shows, great topics, great radio. Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA plus community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.